letters and politics, and economic update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.
Inches cloud below your knees signals 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's only on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Hank Rubicek, along with the team saturated in talent, Greg Audell, Drs. Warren Holloman and Mary Edgerton, and although she's not new to our scene, the very capable Tatiana Gago serving as our media relations representative and orchestrating our band of story lovers by stepping in as lead engineer. If you weren't with us last week, Nicole is taking some time to test career options, and we're in good hands with TG. Our passion, however, remember, is always to celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys through windows of their souls and transport us to mystical worlds before returning us safely to the present. You know, storytellers empower us in many ways, but few are as revealing as demonstrating how stories transform us. However, the power of transformation, as seasoned tellers know, must start within, before their listeners achieve makeovers fueled by the stories they are told. That's what we're all about tonight as my guest storytellers, Tori Mercer, Sammy Relford, Leslie Butcher, and our very own Mary Edgerton will tell us stories about life-changing episodes, and because their narratives are laced with parables and pathos, their stories will probably change us too. How's everybody doing? You're excited.
Woohoo!
Sammy, wonderful.
Sammy, the problem is that you're so shy that we're going to have to bring you out of it, right? You can't wait, can you? I've got a great cast of characters tonight. Believe me, this is great. Leslie, let's kick it off with you. You teach communication at San Jac. You're also a consultant, helping others to build bridges to where they want to be as effective communicators. And your research agenda focuses on reducing speech anxiety. You know, there are a lot of ways to reduce speech stage fright, but I know our listeners want your advice on this one. Tell us about one way that right really surprises in overcoming anxiety.
I think it comes with changing your perspective. You just have to understand that it's normal and you're not alone. Most of us experience public speaking anxiety because it's a physiological response. It doesn't make us less intelligent or imperfect in any way. And so I think that it's just about changing your perspective, saying it's normal. And I always say, if you don't feel nervous, you're not doing it right.
And you are so right. I tell students all the time for the last 41 years, I know I don't look any older than that, but still, I tell them all the time that if you're not nervous, you probably don't care.
Right.
You know, what I tell people all the time is that whenever you're communicating a message, whether it be a story or public speaking, you've got your message in one hand and you have apprehension in another. And the goal is to make sure that the message that you've got is more powerful than the apprehension you feel about delivering it. Does that make any sense?
Yes, exactly.
It's just all about that. It's sort of like a mother who sees her child underneath a car. They find the strength to lift it.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a bad analogy, but you get the idea, right? Okay, now tell us a little bit more about why you got up at the Moth and told that stellar story. It's a great story, but what prompted you to get up that night to tell that story?
Well, I was new to the Moth. My good friend Carrie encouraged me to go a bunch of times, and part about it that I love is the theme was endings. And I firmly believe when we lose someone or we lose a relationship, that when we're able to tell the story of that person, it sort of keeps them alive and it honors them. And that's really what I wanted to do.
Yeah, we met at the Moth, everybody, and the theme that night was endings, and we both told stories that night. It was a great night of stories, really. It really was. And you, Leslie, had the winning tale, and I thought it was the winner. It was so riveting. I loved your story. Now, the narrative is called Santa's Hat, and it changed your life. And that's why I've asked you to tell the story tonight.
Sure.
Tell us your story.
Well, when I was in second grade, our teacher asked us if we knew who was running for president, and I was the only one who knew. And while my teacher was probably surprised, my parents weren't. Before I knew what an Enneagram was, I was this little seven who, from the time I was in kindergarten, had my whole life planned. I grew up in a little cornfield town where we didn't have much. We didn't know anybody, but I had big dreams. I was going to be an attorney. I was going to change the world, and I knew what college I was going to, and I had this whole, my whole life planned out for me. And those dreams kind of morphed from being an attorney to being a broadcast journalism major. So I had this idea I was going to either be Leslie Visser, who was a sports sideline reporter, or I was going to be Barbara Walters. I wanted to interview the janitor and the Pope and people like Sammy and hear their stories. And so I worked my butt off. I became valedictorian in my class. I worked as many part-time jobs as I could. In fact, the summer before I left for college, I worked in a chocolate factory from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., sometimes 6 days a week until I left. I was on work study. I had academic scholarships. I was an athlete. I did everything I knew to do. I was very driven. And the fall of my freshman year at this college in Wilmore, Kentucky, I met this tall, blue-eyed boy from Georgia. And I had spent 18 years planning my life, and I don't think he'd spent a second planning his. He was fearless and interesting. And while I was busy working and studying, he would drag me off to places like Yozo's, which is a Cajun fast food joint, and to giant bookstores. And I was this little girl from a small town living in the big city, and it just felt surreal. We were both communication majors because this college often had a relationship with NBC. I knew I had a good chance of being an intern in the Olympics. That was Sydney at the time. And then the head of our department was the head of ABC Sports for 30 years. So there were a lot of opportunities. And as our first semester sort of wrapped up after finals, one day he called up to my dorm and said, "Hey, I want to do something with you tonight." So I walked downstairs to this really formal lobby, and there he was wearing a dollar store Santa hat, and I was mortified because I didn't just plan things. I was serious. I never watched cartoons. I only debated politics from the time I was little. I don't even think I really knew how to have fun. And he took me to his car, and as we got closer, I realized there were tinsel and Christmas lights inside the car. And I thought, this is so bizarre. And there in the passenger seat was a Santa hat for me. And he said, "I need you to put on the hat." And I said, "Brandon, I'm not wearing a hat. I look bad in hats, but also I'm just not a silly person." And he said something really profound. He said, "I don't want you to miss it." So we got in the car. There was a Jackson 5 Christmas album playing, and we drove around for 3 hours drinking hot chocolate, looking at Christmas lights. And it was probably one of the most magical nights of my life. And we didn't end up continuing dating. We stayed good friends. And Easter was coming up. It was my birthday. And he called and he said, "I have something for you." So I ran down to my lobby that April, just the end of March. And there he was holding that dollar store Santa hat. And I said, "Hey, you should save that. You'll impress another girl one day with your adventures." And he looked at me and he said, "Listen, Miss Planner, I meant that night for you and only you. And I'll never do that with another girl as long as I live." And 48 hours later, I was sitting in my parents' living room in the cornfield of Illinois, and the phone rang. And I thought it would be him to say happy birthday. But instead, it was his roommate who said, "There's been an accident. And he didn't make it." And I talked about the end sort of his life that night, but it really changed the trajectory of my college experience. I went on to the college I told everybody I was going to go to when I was in kindergarten. I got back to the plan. My dreams of being on radio and television died, ironically, though. I'm here tonight. And sure enough, every Christmas, even though I'm a busy planner, my friends will tell you I have 5 and 10 year goals and lots of bucket lists. Every Christmas, I pack my kids in the car and I pull out a dollar store Santa hat And we put on a Jackson 5 Christmas album and we drive around. And I tell myself, just breathe. Because Brandon taught you what Ferris Bueller taught all of us in the 90s. Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around, you're going to miss it.
Oh, that is so beautiful. You all right?
Yes. Yeah.
That is so great. That is so beautiful. You know, I forgot some of that story. And I knew that the shift into that sad segment, at first I remember thinking that really is sad. But, you know, I always remember from my favorite play, I Never Sang for My Father, the Robert Anderson piece. He always says that death ends a life, but it doesn't end a relationship.
Yes.
Right? And that's what I thought about when I thought about your story.
Yeah.
Which is what moved me so much. There are so many wonderful parables in that. And I love the trajectories that you took in that, from humorous to non. And, you know, of all the lessons, what is the one thing, what's the single most important thing that you'd like our listeners to take from that story, Leslie?
Well, I think sometimes when you have a loss, you have an opportunity to sort of fall apart or become resilient. And even though I went on, I'm a communication professor, now I have a great life with my husband. We have three kids and we live in the suburbs. I think it taught me to embrace spontaneity and to just slow down and be present. Yeah. And I still try to think about that today. Yeah. I don't want to miss what's happening in front of me.
Yeah.
And he really did teach me that.
Best advice. Best advice. You really have to focus on the present. On the present. You know, what? One of my guests, Jerry Duncan, became ill and couldn't join us this evening because his story, at least in part, will be told by his autobiographer, Tori Mercer, and his longtime friend and essential player in a story, Sammy Relford, who have graced us by their presence this evening in the studio. But first, let me tell you a little bit about Jerry. He grew up in the Houston Heights in the 1950s, a time of ugly racial segregation. His story is best labeled Forbidden Love, captured by 2 7-year-old boys, one white, one black, Jerry and Sammy. Tori, there's no way that we're going to do justice to Jerry's story, but shed some light on this remarkable person. First of all, tell us a little bit about who you are.
Well, I was a history teacher for a long time and always been a community activist. I've about 6 or 7 years ago, I started dedicating myself to writing and filmmaking, and I've always been a poet and singer and band leader. I've always had a bunch of bands. And that's where I've known Jerry from, is from the music scene.
Yeah, your first chapter outlines the landscape of Houston Heights in the early 50s, and there's a section in the chapter that represents Jerry's mindset especially well. In fact, Sammy, who's sitting right here next to me, I don't know why you have to coach him, by the way. You were telling me you have to coach him. You don't have to coach this guy to do anything. I just wanted to let you know. But, there's a segment in that chapter that I think represents Jerry's mindset especially well. The story is called Color Town, and I do need to let the listeners know this is not the exact title, but we did modify it a little bit for the purpose of radio. But please read that section to us, Tori. Thank you.
Sure. Color Town. N-word has been edited for acceptable radio language. Sammy was an excellent judge of character. My mother was a straight-up racist Baptist, from a long line of racist Baptists, born and raised in Lynch, Kentucky. Yep, Lynch, Kentucky. She rode the bus to and from work, and if she just walked the 2 blocks through Sammy's neighborhood, she would have saved herself an extra 3-block walk. She wasn't about to walk through Colored Town. She walked entirely around. The barricade that separated our block was permeable, but it was no match for the impenetrable mental barricade set up and maintained by Southern culture. She entered the house after telling me sternly, "You heard what I said about those little Negroes?" "Yes, ma'am," I said. The next time we got together to play some more catch, Sammy seemed to know exactly when my mother was due, and he'd split. This went on for several weeks. My brothers and I had a nice time in the summer, playing hide-and-seek in the yard at night. Sometimes Gary came over from next door. One night we were playing outside when Sammy and his brother Jesse, who's about 13, came out of the woods. We were all surprised. When you have never, ever played or had a conversation with a black person in Texas in 1953, the two of them coming out of the bushes at nighttime, It was rather shocking. I took it in stride because I was getting to know Sammy, but everyone else was like, "There goes the neighborhood." Funny, because it was their neighborhood. Sammy asked, "Can you play?" and flashed that smile. His brother Jesse had a look on his face like, "These white people ain't about to play with no Negroes." Without thinking, I said, "Yeah, now that'd be fun." My older brother Ronnie said, "Nah, I don't think that's a good idea." But I quickly countered with, "Let's keep it quiet and no one will know." Sammy's smile got a little wider. Jesse looked as if he had a raised eyebrow, but I couldn't see it. Everyone looked at Ronnie, as he was the oldest. He thought about it and said, "Okay, but let's keep it real quiet." At this time, Gary abruptly said, "I got to go home," and took off at full speed because his mama would likely punish him for playing with those, quote, little Negroes. Just like that, our hide-and-seek game went to another level. Sammy and Jesse's speed just amazed us. We played and ran so hard. That was the night I found out what Grandma's beads were. You see, in the swamp-like humidity of the Texas Gulf Coast in the summer, when kids run a lot, the sweat mixes with the dirt, and it looks like you have black beads around your neck. When my mother called out to us through the front porch screen door and told us, 15 more minutes, Sammy and Jesse hid. I squeezed in between two bushes with Sammy, as my mother was now it. It was at this time that I discovered that black people have a different smell than white people, or at least that's what I thought then. What I found out was how different life was for the families living right next door to me, just across a wooden barricade. All the houses were pure shantytown. There was no electricity in the house. There was no hot water in the house. There was no shower or bathtub in the house. There were usually no heaters in the house, just a gas stove. They had no commode. They had an outhouse in the backyard. Taking a bath or washing clothes was a big deal. In order to take a bath, they would have to do it in what they called a foot tub. It was a galvanized tub that held about 5 gallons. They used it to wash their clothes in, too. When they wanted to take a bath, they had to gather up everything in the house that would hold water and heat it up on the stove, then pour that into the foot tub stationed immodestly in the middle of the kitchen floor and take a bath. In the wintertime, it was brutal. In the summertime, everyone in Houston just sweated a lot, and it was as simple as that. But at first, I just thought black people had a different scent than white people. The iniquity did not make any sense to me at 7 years old, and it is still incomprehensible to me 63 years later. Some folks like to talk about race and class in America as if they are two separate elements on the periodic table. Maybe they are. But in 1953, no one had ever seen one yet without the other. After a few nights of playing hide-and-seek with Sammy and Jesse, my mother, squinting off the front porch into the darkness to catch a glimpse of us, had finally figured it out. She asked, "Y'all out there playing with those little Negro kids?" And all three of us said, "Nope." She knew, but she let it slide with a, "You better not lie to me."
Okay. You know, I want to get Mary's take on this and Leslie's in a moment, but I can't help watching Tatiana, who seemed to be kind of mesmerized. What did you think of that?
Well, you hear about all this stuff in in your history classes about segregation in the 50s, but I've never heard anything like this before.
Right.
So it kept me in awe, so
right.
You could tell from my facial expression.
Keep in mind, Tori did a fabulous job at really capturing.
It was so vivid.
I think, yeah, really vivid.
Oh, thanks.
Really. You're a pretty good writer, my friend.
Well, the voice is all Jerry's.
Well, you know what? The voice may be Jerry's, but somebody has got to make that voice come to life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And you do it beautifully, really beautifully.
Thanks.
I read the entire piece that you sent me. I just thought that this section really captured the essence of his mindset. But, you know, a lot of our listeners may not be able to relate to this, but the wonderful thing about the station is that we understand it. We understand that tolerance is a verb. We have to act tolerant. We have to be tolerant. Mm-hmm. When I was in college, for example, I remember listening on the news that University of Alabama had just been integrated. I'm thinking, what? What you know, because I'm going to college in 1970, and I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I mean, at this time in the 20th century? My point is that it wasn't that long ago. It was not that long ago.
Yeah.
We're talking about something that we haven't forgotten, and we can't ever forget that. Mary, what did you think? I know you're professionally ambidextrous tonight. You're getting us on Facebook Live, and I apologize, but you know, I wanted to get your take on this too.
Hank, it's a wonderful story, and it's one that reminds us of that hatred that was thought to be normal. And I'd like to make sure it doesn't come back into our society as something acceptable.
Yes.
That is so scary to me because I thought we had moved so far forward, mm-hmm. and I hear horrible things.
Yep.
And I don't know. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, it's and not knowing what to say, Mary, is about the best thing we can say because we're all in awe. One of my favorite quotes is from Dante, who says that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in times of great moral crises, remain neutral. Mm. So I think that one thing we have to understand is the power of not being passive. And Jerry wasn't. That's the point.
Oh no.
He wasn't.
You know what I tell my kids? What I always tell them is, okay, don't break the law, right? The law's there for you not to break. Unless the law is wrong.
All right.
And then break the law.
Right.
You
right.
know?
That's
then
right.
you can do that. That's okay.
Right.
So you have to know, you have to have a moral line.
You do.
And Jerry obviously had a moral line. He broke his mother's rules.
And at such a young age.
Yeah, this country was founded on civil disobedience.
Yeah. Leslie, what do you think?
I find myself, I'm right in that weird place of Generation X, sort of millennial. So, but I did grow up in a small town, and I had parents who I often say raised us in a small town, but not small-minded. And so we looked at people just the way we would look at anyone. And my kids are growing up in a society that feels different. But I had a conversation with someone this week, and the reality is there are some of us, because of the color of our skin, that have some advantages, but we also have an obligation and a duty to
yes.
give voice to those people and to create a space for them. And it starts by things like just playing in the backyard
yeah,
and getting up close.
Well said. Well said. Tori, how can we eventually access the story when it's completed?
Oh, maybe in a week or so. You can pick up a copy at Vinyl Edge Records on 19th Street.
Vinyl Edge Records on 19th Street. Tatiana, if you would please seriously make note of that so we can put that on our Facebook page, that would be great.
And if they want to contact me directly, my email, can I give that out?
Absolutely.
My name, Tori Mercer, TorryMercer, then the number 9, at hotmail.com. TorryMercer9 at hotmail.
And we'll get that up as well. Tatiana will take care of that. She can do anything. Jerry was here last Friday, right? He was here last Friday at Rudyard's, and
mm-hmm.
He was also the lead singer to the first Houston punk rock band, Legionnaire's Disease. And I'm sorry I missed that, but he was at Rudyard's last Friday, which is sort of a historical.
It was
renewal.
A great show.
Yeah, well, is the entire group intact?
No, a couple of folks have passed away, mm-hmm. but the guitar player, Gwen Stewart, came out from California. She's a nurse. She traveled with Jerry because Jerry needed a little help. He's
right.
got some health
right.
issues. And, we were hoping he would be here tonight. The
right.
plan was for him to read this story.
Well, please keep us posted because he'll be back, and we want him on, and we want to do the very best that we can to get him on because I want to meet him and I want to get him on here. Right?
Sure.
And speaking of getting on here again, Sammy Relford is sitting next to me, and you were the backup singer in the Isaac Hayes Band, and you ran a couple of soul music clubs in Houston, right?
Absolutely, Doc.
I love this guy. I love this guy. Everybody would if you met him. Well, what are the songs that you sang?
Well, I became successful mm-hmm. on stage instead of successful on the radio.
Right, right.
I made so much money on the stage until I really didn't have to sing, to be
right,
played
right.
at the famous KPFT
right,
radio
right,
station.
Right, gotcha. Can you take about 30 seconds and sing something for us? I gotta hear this. We all
Who
do.
Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Jerry, who's the cat that won't come out when there's danger all about? Doc.
Maybe
he's
Leslie
a complicated
can, yeah.
man.
Maybe Leslie can help you overcome your
No
anxiety.
One understands him but his audience.
That would
Doc.
Probably be a good guy. I love this guy. He has already written the best song I've ever heard, frankly, and I think everybody would agree. Now, Sammy, Jerry saved your life, but But how do you put in about 30 seconds how he really changed your life? How did he change your life?
He made me believe that I was somebody. Mm-hmm. He made me believe that I could be somebody. Mm-hmm. And the way he instilled it in me was like Colonel Parker watching over Elvis Presley.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Great analogy. Now, your friendship with Jerry spanned 65 years. And as I said to Tori, we can't ever cover as much ground as I'd like about Jerry. But Tori told me about the Coke bottle story, you know, which one I'm talking about. And I loved it. I mean, I loved that story because I think, again, it captured the essence of Jerry and his relationship with you in many ways. Tell us that story.
About the Coke bottle?
You betcha.
The friendship. We had an outside toilet. I never used the inside house bathroom until I was like 15 or 16 years old. And we played football in the backyard where the outside toilet was. And if the score was tied, you had to kick the football over the toilet like the field goal between the goal. You had to do it accurate to get 1 point.
Gotcha.
When we got to that point where it was do or die, the game had to be won by the kick, Jerry would be the kicker. Because he was so fundamentally sound in stuff that he did. And he told me, Sammy, we got to win. If they bigger than us, we got to tackle them no matter what. We must win. And that lives in me. To win. And here's my point. My biggest problem, I believe I'm supposed to take care of everybody. You, Doc, you, whatever you wanted to be, Jack Willen, thank you, girl. I owe you up in there for letting me be on your radio show. The next time this radio station have a fundraiser, I better be the first one they call because I'm going to raise enough money that we're going to be the biggest radio station in the world. And I mean it.
Story.
I mean it. I sang to take care of people. Mm-hmm. That's what I do. Even you, whatever you do in broadcasting, sweetheart, I'll change your life and I'm going to do it. I'm going to help you some kind of way. Tori Mercer. He's an historian that needs to be recognized. He's got a lot of talent. He's writing the book, and I'm proud of it.
And I'll tell you what's going to get him recognized really fast is when you talk to us about that Coke bottle.
About the record?
Yeah. Coke bottle.
The Coke bottle.
The Coke bottle.
We did so many things with Coke bottles. We would fill them up with peanuts. Mm-hmm. You ain't seen that in a while. Put the peanuts mm-hmm. in the Coke bottle. And you had to turn it up and eat the peanuts and drink. And then on, there's some words I can't say on the radio. Mm-hmm. But
but let me ask you this. Let me just kind of prompt you. Because when you would take a sip from something, didn't other people not want to sip that Coke bottle?
Under no circumstances.
Right. But he did.
No.
Jerry did. Passing it.
No, but let me tell you this. Mm-hmm. Jerry set a tone. When I take a drink, he take a drink.
Yeah.
He wouldn't pass it back to me. He would give it to one of the other white guys.
Right.
And he better drink out of it.
Right. And if they didn't?
Every day.
Yeah.
When Jerry taught me how to smoke cigarettes, he would steal his daddy's Camel cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Picayunes. They don't even make them no more, Doc. Picayune. But anyway, Jerry taught me that I'm supposed to win and take care of people.
Yeah. And boy, he sure did. He sure did. Mm-hmm. But it's that one, I just want to reiterate this. It's that one, you know, you're saying so much great stuff about Jerry, but you know, the idea of him taking a sip from that Coke bottle after you and then insisting that his white friends take a bottle, a sip after you. That is one of the most poignant and descriptive gestures that says so much about Jerry. You know, I mean, we're talking about what, 1958?
Doc, here's the thing. Jerry set a tone where the whole white neighborhood embraced us as blacks, that we saw no color.
Yeah.
That's why the name of it is called Color Town.
And I think that's also something that Jerry has done for the lives of Houstonians, because this city is known for being diverse. And even though we don't call it Jerry Town, in many ways, Jerry does embody the soul and the hearts of Houstonians. You know, this is Hank Rubicek, and you are listening to stories that change the lives of my guest tellers, Leslie Butcher, Tori Mercer, Sammy Relford, and the very familiar Dr. Mary Edgerton on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica, KPFT 90.1 Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. And here's someone who always changes lives, Tatiana Gago.
Oh, you want me to go?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's me.
You know, our city is as storytelling friendly as it comes, with a variety of venues for every kind of teller, from greenhorns to veterans. Tatiana, tell us about it.
Well, let's begin with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. It is always the best place to start because it's the best place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, located at 1500 Sunset. Be sure to visit Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for upcoming events, including Skyline Screamers, the scariest ghost stories ghost story night in town, and a workshop on crafting personal stories given by Dr. Michael Winters and Dr. Hank. And don't leave the Guild site until you check out our past So What's Your Story programs, every show since 2008, listed on the menu under radio program. And please, don't ever tell us that you can't listen to So What's Your Story because you don't have a radio, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and Facebook Live. And while you're at it, tell us what you think about our shows or suggest program ideas for our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and we promise to get back to you. Don't forget to share our page with your friends, family, lovers, and enemies, and we'd love it if you'd like us when you leave.
Yeah, especially your enemies. Right. Thank you for all that, Tatiana. So What's Your Story is also on YouTube. And remember, our friends at the Moth and Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy fabulous stories and get acquainted with the growing storytelling community in H-Town. Quick note that you can reach any of us, Mary, Greg, Warren, Tatiana, me, and Dr. Hank at kpft.org. Our partner in crime, Greg Audell, is going to be here next week with another edition of So What's Your Story, right here on KPFT 90.1 FM, Pacifica Radio, fueled for peace. My friend and co-host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, is a pathologist at MD Anderson and has been with our program. It'll be 2 years on August 29th. Her signature style, in my mind, is best described as animated conversation. She's able to instill confidence in tellers by letting them know their voices matter. We've had almost 400 stories since 2008, Mary, and that must make an impact on our listeners. It's a really tough question to answer in a few words, but what do you think our program has done to add to our community?
Oh, Hank, I love it. Storytelling. It weaves the community together. It's a place to snuggle up and just curl up inside a story.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a great way of connecting, and it is. It's a cuddling form of expression. Now, you've been a medical author, Mary, and you've also dabbled in nonfiction writing. A lot of us don't know you as a nonfiction writer. What are some of the topics that interest you?
So I wrote a story called Esther. It was in something called Flash Fiction, where in 100 words, I had to tell a single story, and it was about a young woman whose parents had died on the same day because her father shot her mother and then shot himself. She was 13. And it when you have to distill that emotion, and then she talks about having her first child, you're distilling into 100 words. It's pretty hard, but that was one of the things I did. I write a little poetry, and I have some semi-autographical books in mind in which I've said I'm not changing any names because there's no innocent to protect.
Well, you know what? You need to collect those, and we need to do a program, and we need to hear some of those, and we are going to do it. I think it'd be a great sort of an anniversary gift for you, so we're going to be thinking about that. I have an article entitled From Family Storyteller to Talk Show Host, written by Trenor, is that how you pronounce it?
Trainer
Baring. It's about you, and it's in The Pen Women. Tell us about The Pen Women.
So the National League of American Pen Women was started, I can't say exactly when, but I think at least a century ago, as a forum for women writers to publish. And as you might imagine, in the 19th century, that's going back a couple of centuries, that was not so easy. And it has persisted as an organization to support women writers, and it's expanded to women artists. So they take art of any medium along with the art of writing.
Right. Yeah, Tatiana's probably thinking, Dr. Hank, weren't you born in the 19th century? It can't be that long ago. Well, I want to read, if I could, a little bit from this article that was written about you. And if I could, and it reads, there's usually at least one storyteller in every family. For generations, that's how family histories and lore were passed down, one tale at a time. At dinner, on the porch, on long road trips, at funerals, wherever family members were gathered. Not sound bites or tweets, but real, vivid oral histories that take their own sweet time to travel from backstory to resolution. In today's techno-rush culture, is there a place for the lost art of a well-told story? Slow food in a fast-food world? Well, Mary E. Edgerton, Bayou City 2 branch founding member, thinks so. She's one of the four hosts of So What's Your Story, a weekly radio show dedicated to storytelling. And on August 29th, she'll celebrate her second anniversary of hosting. Happy anniversary, Mary. And so how did Edgerton, pathologist, medical book author, and part-time fiction, get involved in So What's Your Story? Well, the pivotal moment occurred at the Moth's live event. She attended regularly with a friend, and then one night got up from the mic or, in front of the mic herself. She began to share stories from her own life, like Leslie did. And, you know, I, on a personal note, Mary really is a wonderful, wonderful storyteller. She's always great about talking about how her hosts are good tellers, but Mary is an exemplary storyteller and a magnificent person and host, and she really is wonderful at bringing women's story to the forefront. Both of her shows in February, for example, one of them focusing on African-American women and the other one on true romantic stories, both really were magnificent, I thought. And it's really Mary's style that makes those stories come to life. But tonight, the story that you're about to tell, Mary, is one that you told at the Moth under the theme of age. It's about you and your mother, and it's deceptively deep and poignant and very life-changing. The theme for tonight. Tell us the story.
So, Hank, I have to tell you that was the first time that I had ever told that story, even though I relived it in my mind many times. I was the youngest child in the family, and it wasn't as though I was years and years behind the oldest. I was 4 years behind the oldest, but she was something of a Nazi camp director. The next was 2 years down, and he was a sweet boy and something of a collaborator, and then came me, always to be the youngest, always the one to be left out, etc. And this is something that persisted. This wasn't just in childhood. So when I was 37, on my second marriage, pregnant with my first child, I called my parents. Now, my brother and sister had each had their children about 10 years earlier. I was the late bloomer, but that's okay. And I said to my father, whom we called Mur, guess what? I'm pregnant. And he goes, oh my God, I have to sit down. I wasn't ready for this. I was thinking, I'm almost 40. It's going to get to be too late. And so I had my two children. And one of our next meetings was maybe 5, 6, 7 years later. And my parents were getting older. And we decided we needed to make sure that all their papers were in order. My father, being a good Texan, wanted to do everything with his handwritten will on the back of an envelope, because his mother had a handwritten will on the back of an envelope. But we decided, you know, it'll be a lot easier if we do this through a lawyer. So my brother took the will, had it transcribed and modernized into a modern will, and brought it down, and all three children and our spouses and children and my mother were meeting. And my sister noticed that my brother had changed the executor from the handwritten will, in which it had been my sister, to him. And they began to argue about this. And then my father said, well, that's okay. Just put yourselves in as co-executors. And all this time, there hadn't even been a mention of me. I think I was about 45 years old, and I just raised my hand and said, well, if y'all two, why not me? And they looked at me like, the baby? And yes, it is true and well known in the family that I had a nighttime bottle till I was somewhere between 5 and 7. But even us late bloomers grow up. Well, time moved on. My father did pass away, and my mother was living in Houston, here pretty close to my brother. My sister was in San Antonio, and I was in San Antonio for a meeting. So I thought, well, this is great. I'll visit with my sister here, or I'll drive over to Houston and have a visit with my brother and my mother, and then I was going to meet some friends in Austin. And as I was getting ready to start my travel, the phone rang quite early in the morning, and my brother said, I'm at Mom's apartment. She wasn't answering the phone, and she was here unresponsive, and I am now following the ambulance to Methodist Hospital. So I said, okay, I'll get Jane and we'll be over. I call my sister, you know, my Nazi commander, camp director sister, and she's going through this, well, I'm at work. I don't know how I can just get up and leave work. And I said, Jane, it's your mother. She's in the ICU, unresponsive. So she got it together, made the arrangements. We drove over, and the three of us were there. My mother had some level of consciousness. She had something called Wernicke's aphasia, where you can't find words. And I would point to a watch and say, what is that? And she would say, it's arugula. And we were talking about nursing homes and PT and what her status would be and so on. The weekend ended. My sister decided to go back to San Antonio. I said, let me stay for a little while longer. I'm really not sure where things are going to go. She was beginning to cycle through pulmonary failure and renal failure. And I knew that that was a cycle that tends to end up in a bad way. So I come in, my brother drops me off on the Monday morning, my sister's back in San Antonio, and I walk in and they said, your mother is in pulmonary distress, and we've, you know, gone from the nasal cannula, which is just a little bit of oxygen to help her, to a face mask, to a 100% rebreather, and our next step would be a respirator, which I knew was not something that any of us, including her, wanted. So I called up my brother. I mean, I'm the youngest. How am I going to make a decision? I called up my brother and I said, you know, this doesn't look very good. And he said, well, you know, on one of the first days where she had pulmonary distress, they use this thing called CPAP. And I can tell you, it's a very uncomfortable machine. It pushes positive air pressure back into your airway while you're trying to breathe. And he said, maybe we can try that. So I said, okay, because, you know, I'm the baby. I was never given permission to make decisions. So I said, let's try CPAP. So the respiratory team came back in with the CPAP machine. And my mother looked at it. And she looked at me. And she couldn't speak. But in her eyes, she said to me, it's okay. You can do this. And I will never forget that look for as long as I live. I looked at her and I looked up at the respiratory team and I said, we will go to comfort care. And with that, I was no longer the baby. I took a silk scarf that I had bought in Italy that I wanted to present to her when she got a little bit better. And I laid it over her. I laid it over her because I knew she loved beautiful things. I insisted that they bring in the priest and give the last rites in front of me so that there would be a member of the family there with her when that happened. And when her final moments came and I recognized that the end was near, I called my brother, because he lives about 30 minutes away, and said, "It'll be 30 or 40 minutes. Ah," he says, "we just put on the water to boil for spaghetti." And I said, "That's okay. That's fine. I'm here." And hung up the phone. And yes, truly, with my mother's blessing, that's when I was no longer the baby of the family.
That night that you told it at the Moth, but I'm certainly glad I didn't miss it tonight. That's a beautiful story. You know, what is the essential lesson that you learned from the story that changed you?
Hank, I will never forget the look in her face of telling me, "It's okay, you can do this." And in a very odd way, as my friends go through what I went through and start to tell me their stories, I learned to be a very good listener and to say to them, mm-hmm. "It's okay."
What do you guys think, Tori?
Well,
heard that for the first time. Pretty amazing.
Listening to that story, it made me think about how universal that theme is that, you know, everybody on the planet goes through, brothers and sisters getting mm-hmm. together when a parent is at the end of their time.
Yes.
And, you know, it gets the pacifist vegan brothers together with the Nazi death camp cannibal sisters.
You know? Exactly.
Wow, that's a hell of a commentary.
And then the baby comes through.
Sammy, it made an impact on you, right? Pretty beautiful story. Beautiful story. You know, Leslie, you're serving up the last story. I know that that the title is a little bit deceptive, and after you're done with this, I'm going to get Tatiana to talk about all the stories. I wanted to ask Tatiana now, but I want to wait till yours and really give her a comprehensive set of impressions. But it's a light-sounding title. It was, again, an episode that changed your life. So tell us the story of, I love this, Shingles, Storms, and Sharpies. I want to add, oh my, right?
Well,
and the light lines and darkness and darkness.
It's almost fortuitous, I think, that we're talking about generations and history and time. And this story comes from really my childhood, but into my adult years. And I often say I don't know if my parents wanted to raise us in the cornfield. They'd gone to college in Kentucky and then had lived in Arizona and Wyoming. They love the mountains. But thanks to the recession of the 80s, they came back to where they graduated high school, to this small town in southern Illinois. And the silver lining for my four brothers and I was that we grew up with our grandparents. They were at everything. When we were sick, when we had a ball game, they were this sort of the fabric of our everyday life. And I loved my grandma, but I had a unique relationship with my granddad. And as I got older, I noticed something about him. He was painfully shy. And that is sort of the antithesis of who I am. I'm an incredibly extroverted person. I have this innate desire to connect with anyone. And he was sort of hard to connect with. He was loving and giving in a very unique way. Blue collar, worked at a refinery. And I knew he was shy, but he would do this thing where if I hugged him, he would sort of shrivel up like it was almost painful. And if I said, "I love you, Granddad," he would kind of half nod, and I could tell it made him uncomfortable. And I don't know if it was growing up in the Depression. I don't know if it was the war. Often we would debate if it was nurture versus nature, but it just always seemed to feel like he didn't reciprocate love in the same way that I necessarily interpreted it. And when I was 9, I started playing softball, and I wanted to be a pitcher. I'm a really type A person, so I was super driven. And he asked me what my favorite soda pop was one day, and I just half-heartedly said Dr. Pepper. And the next ball game, when I went to the dugout, there was a Dr. Pepper with a piece of masking tape, and written on it in Sharpie were the words "to the greatest pitcher in the whole world." And the next game, the Dr. Pepper was there again. And the next year, and the next season, and the next tournament. And it became this sort of neat little thing where I thought, that's so neat. And then people would comment, like, "Oh, your granddad's been in the dugout. He left a Dr. Pepper again." Well, when I was 19 years old, I took an interpersonal communication class, and I was reading the book, The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman. I was writing a paper on it, and I had this moment where I thought, all my life, I remember thinking, I wish my granddad would just say, I love you too. And I realized in that moment that he was saying it with every Dr. Pepper and every Sharpie. And so when I was a mom with three kids, I was planning a birthday party for my girls, and we had 50 people coming over to sing Let It Go and with disco balls and three-dimensional snowflakes. And I was a little stressed. My husband was out of town. I went to the doctor, and they said, you have shingles. And I said, I can't have shingles. I'm not old. And they said, well, I'm sorry you do. And my mom called that next day, and she said, Granddad's sick, and has pneumonia. He's in the hospital. And I said, it's spring break. I want to come up. And she said, you can't. The storms are bad, and you have shingles, and that would be crazy. And I said, I don't really care about the shingles, and I don't really care about the storms. He's 93. I just want to see him. And so I packed up my three kids, and I drove 1,000 miles with shingles and through torrential downpours and tornado warnings, not stopping. And when I got to that hospital, I sat by his bed and held his hand, and I got to say everything you hope to say, that he was the best and that I loved him and that I was proud to be his granddaughter. And when I left, he didn't say, I love you too. He just sort of did that awkward nod. And I got the call the next morning that he had passed. And when I got to the hospital room, I looked over, and there was a little stack of treats that he knew were my kids' favorites. And next to them was a Sharpie. And I heard him say, I love you too. And I think Richard Garnett says the greatest gift one generation can give another is love. And even though it didn't look like what I thought it should look like sometimes, or wasn't the way I wanted it, I heard it with every little Sharpie.
That is such a beautiful story, and I love the application to the five languages of love. It's a book I bought my wife years ago, and my wife is, there's nobody better at showing love than she is. She mm-hmm. shows it in many different gestures.
Yeah.
And I don't pick up on a lot of them. And that's not a good thing. But it's such a wonderful message. And that story itself, all of your stories, I have to tell you, changed me somewhat tonight. I remember components of all of your stories, and they're embedded in my heart forever. It's what I do. It's why I love doing what I do. It's why I love storytelling. And, it never ceases to amaze me how volatility, we're all vulnerable, we're all volatile. That really is the greatest human denominator, isn't it? We're all vulnerable, every one of us. There's something so human about being human.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the definition of human.
Yeah.
It is. It is a definition, Tori, and it's one that we don't think about. We don't conceive as being that meaningful, but my God, it is. Tatiana, what do you think about these stories?
Well, these stories are incredible. Leslie, you actually put a tear in my eye. I was just wiping off before I started speaking.
Yeah.
You know, with saying the words, I love you, it's really hard.
Right.
So your grandfather, he showed it through other ways to show that he loved you, but he did. Yeah. He just showed it by through his actions.
And not to get into the story, but Tatiana knows what I'm going to say. She told a great story in class, and she also told a great story on this program, I guess about a year ago, approximately, about your mom.
Yes, over a year ago.
And I think about that story because it was about saying, I love you. And we don't realize how important it is to say, I love you.
Yeah. Love is a many splendid thing.
It is indeed, my friend Sammy, and not only is that an important cliche, but it is one that is absolutely born of truths. How did this experience, Leslie, transform you?
I genuinely believe we're hardwired for connection. And so I think it was at 19 that I really did sort of for the first time feel really connected to my mm-hmm. grandfather's heart.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And I'll never look at a Dr. Pepper or a Sharpie the same way.
No.
And Doc, my thing for singing when I perform, when you come to see me, I focus on making you know that whatever you do in life, make friends with love.
Yes. Beautiful.
Make friends with love.
Beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Curious, who were your storytellers growing up? Did you guys have a storyteller in your home growing up? Mine was my grandmother. I always talk about that. But Leslie, what about you? Did you have a storyteller in your home?
Probably my dad. He was a history major in college, so he was fascinated with telling us about the past, and he studied his ancestors a lot.
Cool. Sammy, did you have a storyteller in your home growing up?
Yeah. Well, let me say this. When you come to see me, Doc, I want you to see.
Apparently, I'm going to see Tammy. Anybody get that idea?
Because what I do, I change your life. I change your mindset.
I have no doubt.
The
so
way
Sammy
that
was the storyteller.
You treat your brother or your sister.
There are a few things that I can bet on. This is one of them.
You get a book, a story, a movie from me.
Anybody in your home, your mom, your dad, anybody in your home tell stories when you were growing up?
Oh, my mother was the catalyst for my family singing.
Yeah.
Oh, she the one told me to sing, baby, sing.
So stories into singing. Beautiful.
Oh, yeah. You should have came to our church, Doc. You'd have stayed all day.
Tori, what about you?
Oh, I got it from both sides. My mom was the improv storyteller. She's just trying to get me to sleep, so she'd make up some story that'd be endless, go some down road, you know, till it was, you know, I was falling asleep. But my dad was the formal storyteller. He grew up in the wilds of Saskatchewan, and he was very Victorian. So he had a book that was left over from his childhood, probably printed around the turn of the last couple of centuries ago. Probably before around 1900, and I remember it had a lot of these little classic stories like Pandora's Box. Mm-hmm. And so I got the classics, the real classic stories, you know, from his side of the family, very disciplined, very Victorian, very formal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then my mom from Corpus, you know, this, you know, little and very informal.
You know, this whole night, these stories of transformation. Mm-hmm. Stories of transformation. Wait a minute. You're going to be at, what does it say, Sammy? What does it say? Saturday, 8 to 12. This Saturday?
Yeah, this coming Saturday at Renee's on the Bayou.
Renee's on the Bayou. Okay.
2541
North
McGregor
Main.
Way.
Sammy Relford, be there.
McGregor.
Be extremely square. Look, I like this. This show on transformation is really hot because I like what pastor and author Rick Warren says of transformation, because I think it speaks to every story that's heard tonight. Transformation is a process, and as life happens, there are tons of ups and downs. It's a journey, a discovery. There are moments of mountaintops and moments in deep valleys of despair, and I would add places that could have been despair if not for our personal revelations, like the one shared tonight. Thank you, Tori Mercer, Sammy Relford, Mary Edgerton, as always, Leslie Butcher, for proving that stories are transformative, and by doing what all great tellers seem to do so effortlessly, by stretching the boundaries of the human heart. Don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are up next with cool classics for the cooler you. Please make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8, 4, So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek with Tatiana Gago, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT. WFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
KPFT Houston thanks our community partners. Artist Boat, a nonprofit organization providing inspiration and education through unique coastal experiences, including kayak adventures on the waters around Galveston Island and guided walking tours. Visit artistboat.org for more information. And ongoing concerts like Jillian Welsh with a concert at the Stafford Center on Wednesday, August 22nd. More information at jillianwelsh.com. This is KPFT Houston.